This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by the next big thing in anti-inflammatory supplements, a brand new all-natural daily preventative against a host of possible inflammatory issues. Black for Health liquid extract from Future Farm Botanicals. Black for Health combines four plant-based foods, black garlic, black radish root, black cumin seed, and black peppercorn, containing high levels of body-ready healing botanicals. Black for Health supports your liver, skin, cholesterol, blood pressure, and weight management, circulation, and immunity. It's a tasty supplement with liposome complex for optimal absorption. For more information and to order, call 888-841-7216, 888-841-7216, or go to myfuturefarm.com/Hoffman. That's myfuture, P-H-A-R-M, myfuturefarm.com/Hoffman. Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. The subject is medical errors, and we're talking about a great new book, When We Do Harm. The author, a doctor, Dr. Danielle Ofri, is a Bellevue-trained physician. She now serves as an attending physician, teaching doctors over at Bellevue, which is actually one of the hospitals where I trained. I don't think we overlapped, Dr. Ofri, because I hit Bellevue at the height of the AIDS epidemic. I think you caught some of the tail end of that during your training. It was a wonderful, wonderful place to train, but, pretty chaotic place. And, probably there were, some catastrophes, some medical errors. That happens when very sick people hit the medical front lines. So of interest to me, I read your bio, is that in addition to writing, you're a musician. You play the cello. So do you argue for, sort of a work-life balance for physicians? So many physicians are suffering from burnout, especially the ones who work in, busy hospitals like Bellevue. Does that help you extend your medical career?
Well, I'm always leery of the word balance because that puts a little bit of the onus, I think, on nurses and doctors to make sure that their lives are okay. And I think it's important to separate some of the stress at work. While we use the term burnout, I think many people are switching to the term moral injury. Mm-hmm. That is things where the system forces you to make decisions that are corrosive to your, your own ethics and morals, and, give you, for example, so much work you can't possibly take good care of your patients.
Right.
So that I wouldn't call burnout. That I would call moral injury from the system.
Mm-hmm.
And that should be solved by the system, not by, doctors mm-hmm. doing yoga and meditating.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, I do think we need, as human beings, a variety in our personalities just to live life. And I think part of being a physician or a nurse is being a full human being for our patients, being aware of other things in life, the ability to think and feel and have passions. And I think just also to stay sane. So for me, I took up cello when my youngest daughter was born. She's now 14. So I'm 14 years into it. Musician might be a bit too much of a stretch of the term. I would say that I take cello lessons, but I do love it. And it gives me a chance for 1 hour a day. Not that it's just different from doing medicine, but it's temperamentally different in the way that medicine is a chaos of 1,000 things happening at once.
Mm-hmm.
When you play music, you reverse that curve and you're pointing at one thing to get that one note right, to make it sound beautiful, to make music, to think about that composer, what they were trying to convey, and to care about how it sounds, which is something we don't do much of in medicine. So the sort of attention to beauty and the focus. So instead of being pelted in all directions by ringing phones and pagers, you're turning your focus inward and focusing it very strongly, like a laser. And that feels so good. It's so different.
And the writing also gives you an opportunity to think and reflect about your experiences, some of which you're very candid about. I mean, under the duress of, caring for multiple patients under chaotic circumstances, sometimes, we regret the decisions we make. And, I think doctors really suffer because, we go through our training and, we're A-plus students, we're academically perfect. And, we reach all these milestones in terms of our academic achievements to get into great medical schools and great residency programs. And then we confront the chaotic world of patients, which is not like a paper and pen exam. stuff happens.
Yeah, and I think, you know, patients, you know, don't come in where it says, you know, vasculitis, you know, tattooed across their chest. They come in, they just don't feel good, and we have to figure it out. And you're right, things happen at once, a lot is happening, and we have very little time to reflect as to what happened, because there's always another patient to see or 10 more patients to see. And so for me, writing is a chance to take a step back and grapple with the issues that are raised, whether it was a medical error, whether it was a judgment call, whether it was a regret, or pride, or any one of the many emotions that come up. Guilt and shame come up a lot. Mm-hmm. And we don't have a chance to rewind the tape in real life. But in writing, you can rewind the tape. You can turn the case over. You can turn it inside out. You can dissect it. You could turn it into fiction if you want to explore other aspects of it. So for me, the writing is a chance to think more deeply. And certainly, you know, when COVID was happening, you know, it was certainly a tornado. And I started keeping a journal. And that was very helpful because I knew that there's no way I'd remember all of this. And then really in the middle, I began writing about it. And it took 6 months to actually publish it this week. But it was, again, the chance to take it back and think more, you know, beyond just the surviving every day, which was how it felt during the time.
Well, you certainly can offer a firsthand account of what it was like being at one of the hospitals hardest hit in the world, because, you know, Bellevue... you know, I live in that neighborhood, and, you know, and I know the streets that lead up to Bellevue. And at one point, you know, it was just ambulance after ambulance after ambulance trundling up to the Bellevue emergency room. And very, very scary, because, you know, you might have exceeded the capacity of your hospital to handle it.
It was amazing to see how elastic the hospitals were and how much, you know, bigger. I think we were close to 400 at the peak. But however hard we got hit, you know, Elmhurst took a heavier hit, and Lincoln and Queens Hospital. And, you know, it was really a team effort on a huge scale. I mean, New York City has a number of city hospitals that work together. And at some point, we were transferring patients up to 35 or 40 at a time, straight from the ER at Elmhurst or Queens over to Bellevue to help out our colleagues who were actually getting hit even far harder than we were.
Wow. Okay, so turning to one of the topics that, you know, you go into in your book, there's a revolution in medicine, and it's been engendered by advances in computer science. There's something called AI and machine learning, and it's actually gotten to the point where, you know, just as IBM's Watson can play chess better than a human, there are computer programs that can discern subtle patterns in MRIs and CAT scans, as well as trained radiologists. And is this potentially a path by which we can avert mistakes? Because, you know, one of the biggest problems is like a misread mammogram or a misread, you know, X-ray, and that can lead to horrible consequences.
AI has a lot of potential. And certainly there are a number of evangelists for AI. Eric Topol writes wonderfully about it. Bob Wachter from UCSF. And I think AI works very well with, again, things that are fairly straightforward. For example, reading a mammogram, right? And really all you have to do is feed enough images so the system learns what's normal, what's not. And that's really, that's how you train a resident, right? You mm-hmm. have them look at enough images, and over time they can figure it out. And so it has worked actually quite well for things like that, pattern recognition, how to pick up a pneumonia on an X-ray, or identifying a rash on someone's skin. But I think we've also seen that it has to be in conjunction with human, you know, diagnosis as well, because there's a context for all of these. And, you know, we have a lot of issues with racial bias. A lot of these systems are fed images, for example, with mm-hmm. rashes on only
with dermatology. I just read a whole article about it, but, you know, all the dermatology texts are based on Caucasian individuals, you know.
Right. So a rash will look different if the skin is darker. Yeah. And so our systems will also be learning biases. So we need to keep that in mind. I think AI will turn out to be a very useful tool. So, for example, you know, assisting people when you have 1,000 things to do, it can help, you know, wean down the number that you think are of concern, that you can look at in conjunction with a human being. It's also very helpful in places where there isn't good access to medicine. So, for example, in under-resourced countries that don't have dermatologists, or don't have enough ophthalmologists to do retinal scanning for diabetics, there it can be extremely helpful to quickly scan 1,000 patients, pick out the 10 who need to be seen by a doctor for more intensive treatment. So it's a question of how we utilize a tool rather than how do we, instead of turning over our responsibilities, because then once we have the machine come up with the diagnoses, we also have to decide how we want to use them. And that's the difference between being smart and being wise. It's easy to be smart. AI is smart, up to date is smart, and all the doctors and nurses are smart. But wisdom is, you know, garnered from years and years of caring for patients, deciding how one incorporates these things with the patient's belief system, their understanding, their requests, their desires, their philosophy. All these things require wisdom, and AI can't really help with that part.
And the human brain is infinitely more complicated than any AI system that is currently in use, and maybe exceeds the current physical limitations of computing. Because of Moore's law.
The other day, I have a patient who has been my patient since I was an intern. He was discharged with a new heart attack, any new doctor, and got me as an intern. We're still together. I won't even tell you how long that is. But he walked in, this is pre-COVID, one day, and I knew instantly something was wrong. I know because I've known him for decades, and AI can't do that, but I knew, and I really had to dig hard.
Call it intuition, but it's sort of pattern recognition that the human mind is capable of doing. It's like something is not right.
Pattern recognition, of knowing a person. And that of knowing a person, I think that's also the, the selling point for primary care and having a, a doctor or a nurse that is your caregiver for a prolonged period of time, who then knows you when you're healthy, knows you when you're sick, and knows your family, your philosophy, what would happen if something went wrong. That's invaluable. And, sometimes we get so enamored of high-tech medicine and all the specialists, which are all great. I love technology. But we really need in this country is, more primary care for the basic medical care for patients to have. That's the part that's missing.
Indeed. Okay, folks, at this point, let's pause and allow one of our sponsors an opportunity to share this message with you. Naturally occurring black pigments in vegetables, spices, and seeds have been found to have powerful anti-inflammatory effects. Hi, this is Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and I'm excited about what I think may be the next big thing in anti-inflammatory supplements, a brand new, all-natural daily preventative against a host of possible inflammatory issues. Black for Health liquid extract from Future Farm Botanicals. Black for Health combines four plant-based foods, black garlic, black radish root, black cumin seed, and black peppercorn, containing high levels of body-ready healing botanicals. Black for Health supports your liver, skin, cholesterol, blood pressure, and weight management, circulation, and immunity. It's a tasty supplement with liposome complex for optimal absorption. For more information, or to order, call 888-841-7216, 888-841-7216, or go to myfuturefarm.com/Hoffman. That's MyFutureFarm, P-H-A-R-M, myfuturefarm.com/Hoffman, myfuturefarm.com/Hoffman. Thanks for listening. Thanks for supporting our sponsors. And now back to today's guest, Dr. Danielle Ofri, author of When We Do Harm. Okay, so one of the major checks on medical errors these days is our current malpractice and liability system. Now, on the one hand, it terrifies doctors. It increases medical costs because, you keep checking and checking and checking with unnecessary tests. Just to CYA, what those initials stand for.
Yes, we do.
The other hand, if we abandon the malpractice system, as some people suggest, and just have some sort of, ex parte review of cases, will chaos ensue? Will medical errors proliferate when doctors aren't under the gun, so to speak? I mean, it's a terrible conundrum.
Well, let's think about what malpractice actually does. So the only way you can – malpractice is incredibly expensive to pursue. So lawyers can only take about 1% of cases that come to them. The error has to be very grave. You have to be able to prove that the bad outcome was a result of an error, and that's extremely hard to do. And the outcome has to be grave enough to garner a big enough payout to be worth the incredible cost of getting witnesses and doing all this. So as a result – 99% of patients who experience some kind of harm don't get any help.
So it's not a great deterrent. Also, it depends on the value of the life of the person. I mean, if it's a child and, you know, brain injury ensues, it could be, you know, tens of millions of dollars. If it's an 89-year-old who was given the wrong medication, well, their life expectancy wasn't that great.
Right. It's very sad, but that is true. So for starters, it only helps a very small fraction of patients who are harmed. But the second thing is, think about our litigation system. I mean, for most medical errors are committed by very competent and caring clinicians. Mm-hmm. A very tiny few are those negligent idiots who should be thrown out of the practice. Mm-hmm. And those folks, those should go to court, right? But that's really rare. Most often, there's a situation that made the error possible. You know, a nurse gives the wrong medication. You know, it's very rare that there's a, let me just give the wrong one here. Usually it happens because she has too many patients. Mm-hmm. She's overworked. The light is bad. You can't read that. Mm-hmm. You're being interrupted. Oh, there's 100 reasons, even though, yes, she made the error, but malpractice isn't really going to help the next patient, which is really our goal for increasing patient safety. What does help is if we can actually figure out why that happens. So that's on the global scale. Now, for the patient themselves, again, most patients don't get help. We could really think about another system more akin to like workers' compensation. Mm-hmm. You've experienced a harm. Is that harm sort of above and beyond what's expected with the routine standard of care? If so, you get some kind of compensation. If not, you know,
who decides that? An impartial board of medical experts?
Well, you know, Denmark has actually pursued this system, mm-hmm. and it works remarkably well. So many, many more patients are able to be assisted because the bar is much lower, mm-hmm. and it doesn't cost a lot to do. And it's not a penalizing system. It's not looking to find mm-hmm. fault in the doctor. Mm-hmm. It is, though, collecting data. So if we get a lot of cases of unexpected pressure ulcers, for example, oh, where is this happening? Let's know. Go focus on that hospital and try to make that less often. So it's also a wonderful repository for what's happening out there, whereas malpractice really isn't, because it only garners a very small percentage of cases.
And, you know, the other thing is, you know, does it work psychologically? Because, you know, I know of physicians, you know, very, very talented physicians, you know, graduating top of their class, and, you know, inevitably a high volume of patients, an error occurs. And they're absolutely devastated. You know, they're burned out. I've known personally some doctors who've committed suicide when confronted with malpractice cases. What about negative ramifications of a punitive system rather than a system that seeks to address the underlying cause of the problem? And
I think that that's tragic. Again, the punitive system works for those few where there's true negligence at play, and that should be the standard for that. But really, as you said, the most doctors and nurses are working hard. They're trying to do their best, and they are devastated. They don't need to be punished by the system. They're usually so traumatized mm-hmm. that you're right. Suicide.
They're conscientious individuals. If they weren't, they wouldn't have gone into medicine. Usually,
exactly. The unconscientious ones. Take those folks to court. Mm-hmm. But everyone else, and of course, if every doctor and nurse who made an error ends up quitting, we're not going to have any doctors and nurses left. Right. So that's an adverse outcome for patients. Mm-hmm. So we need a system that treats the clinicians and the patients better. I mean, patients don't have a good time in the malpractice system either.
No, you know, it's not very fair. Yeah.
And even if they win, which is rare, it's not a win. You know, and mm-hmm. it takes 5, 6, 7
years. Yeah.
Right. Whereas the sort of workers' compensation system, you know, usually it's resolved in a matter of months, and either you get a payout or you don't. Mm-hmm. But the goal is to make the error less, you know, common in the future. That's the real primary goal of that kind of system.
In the book, you emphasize the importance of patients as self-advocates. Is that, you know, patients are actually part of the care team. And passive patients who enter, you know, procedures or undergo hospitalization blindly or without advocates, because if you're really sick, you know, you're non-compos menti, you can't take personal responsibility, but you can have an advocate by your side who can observe, question, you know, ask, is this the right procedure? Even, you know, make sure that people coming to the bedside are washing their hands appropriately.
You know, I feel mixed about that, because patients shouldn't have to be the advocates in the system, right? We should have a system that takes care of patients and produces good outcomes and not bad outcomes. But you know, we haven't achieved that pristine state of perfection yet. Thus, patients do need to be advocates either on their own or with someone else. Because you're right, if you're feverish or nauseated or terrified, it's very hard to be advocating. But, you know, some patients don't have an advocate. People who live alone or might be undomiciled may not have someone. And that's difficult because you do need another set of eyes on the ground. Medical care is so complex these days that you do need another set of eyes keeping track what medications are coming. You know, why is this study being done? At the very least, I suggest to patients at least ask what every medication is, why it's being given, you know, and write them down. And that is the doctor's and nurse's job to explain these things to you. And if they seem like they're too busy to explain it, then get the patient advocate of the hospital or the ombudsman on the phone, because that is their job.
Indeed. So bottom line, I mean, this is a problem that is inherent in medicine. Assume that, you know, we have the opportunity to enact political change in this country at some point in the near future. What would you advocate?
Oh, boy, the list is long, but a few things I think are important. One thing we don't have in the United States is a central repository for medical errors and adverse events. So we have no way to collect data, so we don't even know where to be looking. So we need a system where, you know, doctors and nurses can report even near misses. Now, of course,
and blamelessly too, because there's a lot of there's concealment. I mean, frankly, since there's an adversarial system, it's hard for doctors to admit errors. I mean, you know, if you make a mistake, I mean, the natural human impulse is to pick up the phone and say, look, you know, I got to say, I'm really sorry that, you know, we gave you that wrong medication, or that the surgeon, you know, nicked your, you know, artery. But if you do that, your malpractice insurer will say, well, why did you do that? You know, it's an admission of guilt.
Exactly. So the part two is that there has to be a separate system. So again, Denmark has this wonderful system where you can file a report, and that is separate from the malpractice system. And no report that's filed there can be used, you know, in court against the doctor. There's a separate system for that, but there's an ironclad wall between them. So that's really important. So that's the big one that I think needs to happen. And I think the second is to have a non-punitive way, like the workers' compensation, to address the vast majority of, you know, smaller errors or adverse outcomes that deserve some attention but don't need someone to be taken to court, you know, for 5 years.
You're right. We need a reform of the system. You know, and I say this from the standpoint of, you know, as a physician, because the threat of malpractice, you know, looms large for us in the medical field, and it can have a devastating effect on our morale. But, you know, we do need a system, and we do need to acknowledge our errors and do a better job. Hospitals have a review system, though. It's called M&M review. Isn't that something that you undertake? And it's been a while since I practiced in the hospital, but, you know, you go over cases and you say, you know, how could we have done this better?
Sure. The Morbidity and Mortality Conference is an academic conference to examine, you know, cases that didn't go as well as they should have. Now, that's supposed to be completely academic and everything is confidential. In the past, they were pretty histrionic, and a lot of, you know, burning someone at the stake, usually it was the intern.
Right.
And we're trying to move back from that and make that an
educational experience.
Yeah, so that's important. But we still have this idea that somebody did something wrong, as opposed to, how did the system make that error possible? You know, if you're taking care of too many patients, well, then you're guaranteeing error. And that's the error in the system, not that the person forgot to check the potassium, but we have a system that makes it impossible. Or we have an electronic medical record that floods your brain with minutiae that you can't possibly think. And so you make a misdiagnosis because you're busy filling in the boxes of a ridiculous computerized system.
Yeah. And, you know, I can certainly relate to that, because there was a time at Bellevue when, you know, there was kind of almost like a, you know, it was like a game of chance. You know, you'd have a team of three or four interns, and, you know, we would admit on different days. And it was kind of the luck of the draw. Like, some nights you were really lucky, had like one or two admissions. And some nights you'd have like four, five, or six admissions. And the nights when the other guy got a lot of admissions, I would say, wow, I really dodged a bullet that night. But then I became the recipient of that. I remember at one point my patient load as an intern swelled from 6 to 7 to 8 to 9 to up to 15. And the other interns on the team had like 5 or 6 patients. And it was kind of like, well, they're lucky. They don't. And finally, you know, my junior resident who was in charge of us and supervising us, you know, a young physician, and him or herself, said, "This isn't fair. You've got to take some of Hoffman's patients off his hands. He's just getting fried here. He can't cope with it." And, you know, unfortunately, that those are situations that, that happen in big hospitals.
Right. But I think we have to think about that in terms of patient safety. So there are data that from the nursing perspective, for every additional patient added to a nurse's roster above a certain level, the error rate goes up and the mortality rate goes up. Mm-hmm. And you can see that on a shift-by-shift basis. So rather than having to reinvent the wheel every time, maybe we have a system that says, okay, you know, when the patient census goes up, we need this many extra nurses. We need to bring in an extra physician because it's not safe for one doctor to have 15 patients on their own rather than improvise every single time.
Exactly. Well, we did an improv and reduced the load finally, but I came pretty close. You know, the expression skiing on the edge of your skis, you know, I was just about to spin out. So another element to this error equation is fatigue and sleep deprivation. And that's very real among young physicians, nurses to some extent. Measures are being undertaken to limit the number of hours, consecutive hours, that physicians need to be on call. But that's actually been criticized because they say, well, you know, how are you going to train a good doctor if you put them on like an 8-hour shift? That's too cushy. They need to, you know, it's an intense period. It's boot camp for doctors.
Right. Well, one thing is that you have to recognize that usually the criticisms come from the previous generation, you know, back in our days.
Yeah, exactly.
But we have to recognize that medicine has changed. You know, back in our days, maybe you weren't having 24 hours, you know, surgery and CT scans. You know, things calmed down at night and on the weekends, mm-hmm. but no longer. Also, length of stay was much longer back then. So it isn't really comparable. The second, though, real thing is to recognize the trade-off that the more you control hours, the more handoffs you have. And handoffs increase the rate of errors.
Right.
Because, so you have to balance them.
Yeah. It's best to, you know, if one doctor is there most of the time caring for a very sick patient, they're more familiar. And the handoffs, unfortunately, are pretty fast. You know, in my day, it was done with index cards. It would be like, okay, here's our patients that, you know, we need to watch. Index card with about a 2 or 3 minute explanation. And, you know, you had to communicate in a very cursory way, sometimes a pretty hairy situation with a patient, and then that doctor would go home and you'd be responsible for the other, you know, you were covering the other doctor. And that,
right.
You know.
So knowing that, then hospitals need to say, okay, handoff is a critical time. So we should allot an hour for handoffs so the doctors can either see the patients together or mm-hmm. talk in depth rather than assume you'll fit it in somehow in your magical extra time that nobody has. So the paying attention to these realistic things rather than just sort of letting people figure it out on their own would be very beneficial.
Indeed. All right. Well, we covered a lot of ground here, and there's a lot more to say about the subject in your excellent book. You know, you're a great writer, and that's sounds like an oxymoron. Doctors are a great writer, but you've incorporated both skills. And, you know, clearly you're a, you know, compassionate and thoughtful physician, and you reflect on your work. That's the substance of the new book, When We Do Harm. And as a reminder, Dr. Ofri is the author of a great new article that appears in this week's New Yorker. It's just been posted, a Bellevue doctor's COVID-19 diary, where she recounts her experiences on the front lines at Bellevue Hospital, where a lot of COVID patients landed. Check it out. Daniel Ofri, thank you so much for being who you are and, you know, witnessing, you know, some of the, especially with COVID-19, some of the real seminal events of our time.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. Hi, this is Dr. Ronald Hoffman. As you know, this is a vital time to bolster our immune defenses. I've received countless requests for a specific list of supplements that I recommend to support immune health. That's why I've created the Intelligent Medicine Immune Support Protocol, my supplement recommendations offering the greatest boost for your immune system when it's needed most. Best medicine is preventive medicine. Just go to drhoffmanstore.com for more information. drhoffmanstore.com. In addition to the immune support protocol, you'll find easy-to-follow links for our supplement starter kit, heart health protocol, and much more. These protocols are an easy way for you to get the exact combination of targeted supplements you need to help you follow the intelligent medicine lifestyle. The same supplements I take for myself and prescribe for my patients. And for a limited time, you'll get free priority shipping on all of your store orders. For more details, just go to drhoffmanstore.com. That's drhoffmanstore.com.